Well, hi everyone. I'm Janet V. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. Welcome to everyone. And tonight I'm just going to do a talk that I wrote a few years ago called Building a Bridge to God. And I hope it's helpful to y'all. So as I said, I'm Janet. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. And I just want to give you a quick summary of my history before I talk in depth about what I've learned is the real was the real cause of my binging, and even more important, how God saved me. I first came into OA when I was in high school. I was already a full-blown compulsive eater. I stole food. I stole money for food. And at my worst, I was binging and making myself throw up six times a day. I had to have my esophagus surgically repaired because of the abuse that I heaped on it. And if I was going to show a picture, sometimes people show pictures, I would have to like look through clip art and find a picture of a zombie, because that's what I looked like, a walking dead person. I could be in a room with all of you and feel like I was the only person on the planet. I was a compulsive liar. I made up crazy stories, like including cutting myself with a razor, pretending I was mugged or raped, going to a hospital for a fake rape exam. I continued acting this way, and I continued binging and purging. During my first 6 years of OA, I was making up fake rape stories while I was in OA, until I was introduced to the 12 steps and the God who I believe launches search and rescue programs for all addicts. And once I surrendered my life to God and committed to work this 12-step program, it was like a hand reached into my soul and yanked out the obsession. And now, by the grace of God, I've been in recovery over 40 years, and I'm always excited to talk about this God who is like alive and well and still working miracles. So the first thing I want to talk about are the things I tried and why I thought I binged and why I realized I was wrong. I went to OA, I was 15 years old, and I was relieved to know I wasn't the only one who ate this way. I knew there was something wrong with the way I ate. And I heard other people, they used to eat that way, but now they didn't. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get better. But I was like a diabetic going to Diabetics Anonymous and not injecting the insulin. Just because I hang out with other diabetics, I may feel good, right? Now I have fellowship, but I'm not going to get better. But even worse, it would be like going to a Diabetics Anonymous meeting and no one talking about insulin or blood sugar lowering medicine. They just talked about like their day and their problems with their husband or how they were raised or things like that. And there were these big books, but like no one used them. And no one ever talked to me about being honest, about surrendering, about helping other people. It was all about take a food plan and stick to it. So I tried to figure out why, in spite of going to meetings and having sponsors and doing assignments, I didn't get better. And I thought maybe it was circumstances. I blamed it on my lousy upbringing, which in hindsight really wasn't lousy. And I really say that with kind of a choke in my heart, because today is 1 year from the day that my mom passed away. And my parents were absolutely wonderful, loving people. But I didn't know it at the time, and I just blamed them. And I thought I binged because I was miserable. But I remember, again, remember I started in high school. So I was in high school, and this college boy invited me to the Beach Boys concert. Okay, those of y'all who are around my age know who the Beach Boys are and know that when you're 16 and this like 18-year-old boy invites you to a Beach Boys concert, it doesn't get better than that. And I binged. So I thought, I must be binging to sabotage my happiness, right? Like, okay, I'm not miserable. Oh, I must be, you know, all this psychological stuff. And it was wrong. Circumstances are never the cause of relapse, right? I think a lot of people of us have been to meetings where people say, and maybe have been guilty of saying ourselves, I broke my abstinence because dot, dot, dot. And there was always like the lousy boss, the rotten husband, the annoying kids, you know, something. But I've since learned that if we're eating compulsively, it's always 100% of the time because there's something wrong with our spiritual condition. I believe in the AA 12 and 12, it talks about the early AAs going off to war. I can't think of a circumstance more stressful than that. And they stayed sober. And remember Jim in chapter 3 of the big book, he had his family, he had a job, all was going well externally, but it says he failed to enlarge his spiritual life and he got drunk. And we can contrast that with Bill Wilson in the chapter A Vision for You. On page 154 of the big book, it says he was bitterly discouraged in a strange place, discredited and almost broke. I mean, that sounds pretty bad. But instead of getting drunk, he started Alcoholics Anonymous because, and I think this is important, because he had surrendered his life to God and he was protected. See, we don't not binge because we're good. Sometimes people say, I was good today. No, it's not a matter of being good or working hard. The only way I'm able to not binge is if I'm protected by God. It never has to do with our circumstances. And I was thinking about the line in the big book that says, we're placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. And I picture this island called neutrality that God puts me on and keeps me there safe and protected unless I wander off and I decide I want to go look for greener pastures. So it wasn't circumstances that kept me binging. What was it? Lack of knowledge? Did I need to understand better what foods were triggering me? I had food plan after food plan that eliminated binge foods. And I must have done that assignment to like write a history of your compulsive eating, I don't know, 25 times. And guess what? I still couldn't stop because my problem wasn't lack of knowledge, right? Imagine someone going to an oncologist, being showed an X-ray or a CAT scan and being told, see that spot here? That proves you have cancer. Okay, now that you know you have cancer, now you know that you're a real cancer patient, now go make your cancer cells stop multiplying. Of course, a doctor would never say that. Yet how many times was I told that if I really understood I was a compulsive eater, I could stop? No, knowledge doesn't do it. So if it's not circumstances and it's not knowledge, maybe I didn't want it badly enough. During my first 6.5 years of OA, I had about 50 different sponsors. I'm not exaggerating. And I kept getting dropped or dropping out with people thinking and maybe saying, oh, she just doesn't want it badly enough. I think sometimes people assume if someone can't stop binging, it's because that person doesn't really want to stop. We confuse desire with power. But on page 24 of our big book, it says that at a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, or for us, eating of every compulsive eater, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking or overeating is of absolutely no avail. So there I was, 6.5 years in, still binging, with my binges growing more and more frequent. I had the knowledge, I had the desire, but I didn't have the power. Okay, what does it mean to have no power? Obviously, there wasn't a furry little creature that kept shoving my hand, you know, into a bag of this or a carton of that. It was me who did it. So what does it mean to have no power? And I think this is so important to understand that the writers of the big book put this paragraph that explains it in italics. So on page 24, it says, we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Okay, so let's break that down. They're telling me that normally my defense against doing something dangerous is my memory. So let's say I'm about to touch a hot stove. In my memory are stored all these data points telling me that touching a hot stove is dangerous. So if I'm about to touch a hot stove, my memory sends a little thought running across the bridge to my conscious mind and says, stop, danger, hot stoves will burn you. And then I don't touch the stove. Or another example, I have a terrible cat allergy. So stored in my memory are a bunch of data points of cat-induced asthma attacks. So if I'm tempted to go into a pet store or visit a friend who has a cat, my memory will scan the data, generate a little thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind to say, stop, danger, cats will give you an asthma attack. So again, my memory protects me. But now let's go to food. The best example I can think of for myself is in college, I used to binge on these certain kind of cookies. They would come in a box of 20. I would say, I'm just going to have one or two. But we know how that story ends, right? Eating the whole box of 20, sometimes a second box, throwing up, gaining weight, feeling miserable. So in my memory were all these data points of how I promised myself, I'm just going to eat one or two, but I end up eating the whole box. So there I go, about to go down to the drugstore to buy a box of cookies to just have one. And my memory scans the data. You said you were just going to have one, but you ate a whole box. You said you were just going to have one. You ate a whole box. You made yourself throw up. You were miserable. You were sick the next day. Generates a thought to run across the bridge to my conscious mind where I make decisions to say, stop, danger. You won't be able to stop at one. You'll eat the whole box. You'll hate yourself. You'll be miserable. Don't do it. Except unlike with hot stoves and cats, when it came to food, the bridge was broken and the thought couldn't get across. My memory failed to hold me in check, and I had no defense against the first compulsive bite. There's a saying I used to hear, I don't know if they say it anymore, keep the memory green. No, I had no ability to keep the memory green or pink or any color. I couldn't just tell myself to stay away from certain red light, trigger foods, binge foods. When it came to food, the bridge between my memory and my conscious mind where I made my decisions was broken. And once broken, you know, so it's not like, oh, now I understand. Now I'll really remember. No, once the bridge is broken, it can never, ever be repaired. I was hopeless. Bill Wilson talks about that. When he realized he was hopeless, page 8 of the Big Book, he says, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksands stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. For me, food was my master, and I had a broken bridge. So how did I recover then? How do we all recover? What do we do when our bridges are broken? And the answer is we build another bridge, and that's a bridge to God. And it starts with willingness. Now, remember, willingness doesn't mean being willing to stick to a food plan, because I am powerless to do that. Willingness means being willing to do the work that allows God to come in and remove the obsession, rewire my heart so that I'm not the same selfish, self-centered person, and place me on that island of neutrality where I'm safe and protected. I heard someone say, willingness allows grace to enter. And on page 58 of our Big Book, it says that if you want what we have, what do we have? A spiritual experience as the result of these steps. And the spiritual experience results in the removal of the obsession. And are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to work certain steps. Then and only then are you ready to take the steps. In other words, if a person isn't willing to go to any lengths, they shouldn't expect to recover. Now, if you're a smart aleck like I used to be, you might say something like, well, I'm not willing to rob a bank or divorce my husband. So does that mean I can't recover? But of course, the willingness they're talking about has to be in line with the recovery principles in this book. And robbing a bank would clearly violate the principle of dishonesty. And by the way, while we're talking about dishonesty, I want to say that for my first 6.5 years, nobody stressed to me how important it was to be honest. I mean, we read the beginning of how it works at meetings, right? You know, those who do not recover or those who cannot or will not give themselves to this program, people who can't be honest. Thank God at one point, a sponsor said to me, you have to be honest. If you're not, I'm not going to work with you. And then I realized like, honesty was not only nice, it was critical. If I'm doing everything else, making phone calls, going to meetings, trying to follow a food plan, doing inventories, but I'm dishonest, I will get nowhere. Because if I'm dishonest, it's like I'm putting up a sign that says, keep out God. God won't coexist with dishonesty. Okay, so now let's say we're willing. We have a commitment to be honest. What next? Next, we need faith. Faith that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. I once looked in the book to see, okay, where does recovery really start? If my problem is lack of power, where do I start getting power? So it doesn't start with admitting we're powerless or getting the right food plan or making a certain number of phone calls or meetings. On page 46 of the big book, it tells us that as soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we took other simple steps. I mean, I always find that line so exciting. Remember, lack of power is my problem. So my solution has to be an infusion of power. And as soon as I admit the possibility of God, I get power. Well, this is all well and good if I have a great working relationship with God, but if I'd had a great working relationship with God, I wouldn't be here in the first place. So what do I do if I believe in God, but I don't think he can or will help me? Or what if I don't believe in God at all? Or like me, I believed in God, but I think now looking back, it was like a genie in the bottle, God. Like, God, come out, remove my food obsession, then go back in your bottle and leave me alone. I basically was treating God like my servant instead of saying, I'm going to be God's servant. So what do we do? Well, on page 158 of the big book, we see AA number 3 saying, I'm paraphrasing it, maybe God can help me, maybe. His faith started with a maybe. And I found that when we're starting out, if we're not sure that God can help, or even if he's there, it's okay to say maybe. The prayer may go something like this. God, I'm not sure if you exist. And if you do exist, I don't know if you care about me. But if you are there and you do care, I need some help. And the worst thing that may happen is that there's no God and we end up talking to dead air. But what if there really is a God? What if there is? And that prayer sets things in motion. The big book also talks about things that can actually block our belief in God. Bill talks about having scales of pride and prejudice that blinded him to the reality of God, like pride, thinking of myself too much and or thinking too much of myself, and prejudice, thinking too little of others and or thinking of others too little. So in the chapter, We Agnostics, we're told that we have to look at our prejudices to see what's blocking us from God. And they also remind us on page 55 of 3 things that can obscure our view of God: calamity, bad things that have happened to us, pomp, worship of myself, and worship of other things, right? Our idols, money, career, another person. So I think like we have to find out our own personal prejudices and idols. So remember on page, I think it's 55, it says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be blocked by pomp, calamity, worship of other things, but or some form or in some form or another, it is there. So they are telling me that when God created me, he gave me 2 lungs, 2 kidneys, a heart, a stomach, and somewhere in there, he planted the fundamental idea of himself. It's just blocked. Just like cataracts can block us from seeing the physical world, my prejudices and my idols can keep me blocked from seeing God. So once we have faith, what's next? Remember, I can believe in God and still live a selfish life. But once we have faith, the next layer of our bridge is surrender. We make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. And what does that mean? It simply means I do what I think God would want me to do and leave the results up to him. And I think this is important to understand, like what it is. It's a whole paradigm shift. You know, generally we have goals, and the goals may be good ones, like raise respectful children, get my husband to stop smoking, but they're my goals. And it's radically different if my goal is simply to do God's will. So in this example, if my goal is to raise respectful children and I try my hardest and I do the right things, I teach them to say please and thank you and not interrupt. But what if they're not respectful? I'll get resentful and fearful and feel like a failure. and probably start doing a lot of wrong things like screaming or manipulating in order to reach my goal. However, if my goal is simply to do God's will, and I believe that God's will is for me to teach my kids to be respectful, I'll try my best with him, but I'm a lot less likely to be angry, fearful, and frustrated because I'm not focused on the results, having my children be a certain way. I'm only focused on my obedience to God. So the goal shifts from achieving something, even if that something is good, to simply doing God's will. And that's all that surrender means. I surrender my kids' future. I surrender my health. I surrender who's going to get elected president. I just surrender. My life becomes, in a way, narrow, right? Because my focus is simply, God, what would you have me do? But in a way, so big, because now God is in charge of my life. So there's like so many adventures I may have. What a great sense of purpose he can give me. So now I've got a layer of willingness, a layer of faith, and a layer of surrender. I've got a little rickety bridge that's connecting me to God, but there's more work to do because I need a bridge sturdy enough to withstand the certain trials and low spots that page 15 promises me are ahead. So I need to clear up the obstacles on the bridge, the things that are blocking me from really getting up close and personal with God. And those obstacles are my resentments, my fears, and the harms I've committed. I inventory those, I share them with an understanding person, generally our sponsors, and then I take a nice long look at my defects of character, the things that block me from God. And I think steps 6 and 7 are really cool. Even though I caused these obstacles, these boulders, God doesn't make me lift them myself. He could have. He'd had every right to say, you know, Janet, you made this mess. Now you clean it up. But he knows that I can't. So he picks up the boulders that are too heavy for me to lift, and he removes my character defects. That's how much God loves us. He helps me to build my own bridge to him. And once my defects are removed, I can go out and make amends to the people I've harmed. And then I've got my sturdy bridge. I have a connection with God as long as I continue doing 3 things. I have to clear away the wreckage of each day, which means, you know, a nightly review. You know, and lately I've thought, I think it's so important to go deep and not just surface. So it's like, if I say, was I kind and loving toward all? Well, maybe I was nice to people, but how was my heart? Was I kind and loving in my heart? What could I have done better? I mean, there is never a day where I can say, nothing, I did everything perfectly. We're always looking to, you know, better. Do we owe an apology? Were we looking to see what we could take from life or what we could put in? We really look at these things. We want to clear away the wreckage of our day so that we can do step 11 and communicate with God through prayer and meditation, right? What good is it to say, God, I'm going to do your will, but not give him the time and space to let me know what his will is? I mean, at my job, I make sure to give my boss time and space to tell me what he wants done. How much more so do I need to do it for my real employer, my employer with a capital E, as the book says? And, you know, I make sure to spend a decent chunk of time with God every day, generally between 30 and 60 minutes in the morning, between prayer, meditation, spiritual reading. I like to read spiritual, I read the Bible, and then I read spiritual things that like excite me about God. And I pray, the nightly review is really like a repentance. I always start with praise because our big book says that we have to worship something. We're hardwired to worship. So I start with praising God. I thank him for things in my life. And then I pray for people who need help. I pray for my kids. I pray for the world. I pray for what I think I need to get through the day, for God to remove any selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear. And then I meditate. I set a timer for usually 10 to 15 minutes. And I just pray for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out, and ask how I can help the still suffering compulsive eater. And if there's something pressing on my mind, I'll say, God, you know, can you give me some guidance on whatever the subject is? And then I listen. And there are days when nothing comes to me, and there are days when things come to me. People hear God differently. I have a friend, she hears God audibly. She just has like conversations with him. I usually get it. It's like a line from the Bible, the big book, or a song. Just like a thought comes into my head that wasn't there a second ago, that it's like he put there. And then the third thing we have to do is help other people build their bridges. And if we do that, we are promised immunity against compulsive eating. The first line of the chapter, Working with Others, tells us that nothing will ensure immunity from compulsive eating as much as intensive work with others as alcoholics, or for us compulsive eaters. Immunity, it's like if we get a vaccination against a disease, we're immune from it. By building my bridge and helping others to build theirs, I have immunity against the disease of compulsive eating. And it also says that then we practice these principles in all our affairs. So that means that, you know, it doesn't do any good for me to be praying and meditating if I'm not practicing the principles of honesty, self-sacrifice, tolerance. You know, I seek to grow in being more tolerant, which means my ability to withstand pain or discomfort is raised, that little things shouldn't bother me as much as they used to before I worked the steps. So when I started talking, I said that I believe God launches search and rescue programs for addicts. He certainly launched one for me, and he didn't just rescue me. He restored not only my sanity, but my life. He has totally remade me. I used to be a woman who, like I said, made up. I would literally take a razor and slash my lip and, you know, make cuts and just say, I was mugged, I was raped. I don't lie anymore, ever. When my kids were teenagers, they would say, Mom, did you look at my text? Because they knew that if I did, I would have to confess. And I remember when my son was 18, I overheard him talking to his girlfriend, and he said, my mom's a lot of things, but she's not a liar. And I guess for an 18-year-old, that's a pretty good compliment. I got my kids successfully through the teenage years. Now they're both in their early 20s. I have really, really good relationships with both of them. My marriage is good. My career is good. And even during the time of COVID, I still had a great sense of purpose. I have some wonderful friends, and I have a God who I believe, no matter what happens, will always have my back. And I've lost my fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. So I want to just close with a few thoughts for specifically for the compulsive eater listening today, who maybe is feeling like I felt for my first 6.5 years in OA, when I went to meetings and made phone calls and turned over my food and went through a revolving doors of sponsors and still didn't get it. Those things weren't enough, because the only solution put forth for a real compulsive eater is a miracle. Remember when Bill was 12-step by Ebby, he said, here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. Well, that sounds kind of hopeless. Like, how do I make a miracle? I mean, is God up there flipping a coin, heads Janet recovers, tails she doesn't? No, the coolest thing is that our big book gives us the recipe for a miracle. On page 57, when describing a hardcore alcoholic who was restored to sanity by God, the book says, what is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Okay, they are saying that the elements of a miracle are simple. And then they give us the recipe. 1, circumstances made him willing to believe. There's his first and second step. He was willing to do the work. He was willing to believe that there was a God who could restore us to sanity. Then he humbly offered himself to his maker. Then he knew. His third step, he surrendered to God. Then he knew. So an admission of powerlessness, willingness, surrender, cleaning up our past, then cleaning up our day, praying and meditating to know God's will, and helping others. Every one of us can have that miracle. If this former broken train wreck of a woman could recover, anyone can, because there really is a God who is alive and well, and I believe just waiting to help us all build our bridges to him. And with that, I will pass.